Thank you, Don. It was very impromptu. That's good. We are here for something genuine. And as you guys know, this is what we do is we watch a TED Talk and discuss. We like the TED Talks because they're normal people, or everyday people who aren't necessarily coming from a spiritual perspective. They're just telling us about what they know based on their own experience, based on science, based on other disciplines. So we kind of get the man on the street perspective on what we're learning here at Awakening Together. So today we have a doubleheader. They are both short, well, shorter than normal. And I thought that as I was looking at them, I thought they fit together perfectly. So I think together they're about 25 minutes. So without further ado, oh, there is a little bit of further ado. You might want to take yourself some notes so that you'll remember what you want to discuss when it comes time to discuss this. Yay, Shauna, good girl. All right, so I'm going to share my screen and we'll get right to it. I will turn off my camera to save bandwidth.
Hi, I'm Chan Su, and you just saw me coming in and you saw how I'm dressed today. And before I even started talking, I bet he had formed your first impression on me. Now let me ask you just two details. How old am I and where am I from? Well, if I were you, I would have guessed this is this like 30-year-old crazy guy from Korea who tries to bring breakdance back to Germany. Well, the true answer is I'm 43 years old and I was born here in Munich and I grew up here in Germany. Now, how many of you have guessed this right? Please raise your hands. Okay. Well, this happens to me all the time. People misjudge my age or my origin. But think about yourself now. Do you remember that somebody has misjudged yourself? Maybe unfair? Or do you remember that it was a time that it was you who has misjudged somebody else? Today, I'm going to talk about why we are likely to make such mistakes in our judgment and how we can avoid making these mistakes by a simple principle. But before I start explaining, let me ask you just one more question. Do you get annoyed by people who always want to be right? Please raise your hands. Okay. Well, you know, this reminds me of when 7 years ago when I started my PhD in psychology. She told me, oh, Chan, it's great that you do this research in psychology, but, you know, for me, this is not necessary. Because when it comes to people, I am always right. No, really, I always observe that people behave exactly the way I predicted. Well, this got me thinking. How can she be so sure of herself? Or maybe is it an illusion? And if it is an illusion, are there any psychological mechanisms behind that illusion? Well, I found a whole body of research in psychology explaining this illusion. It is called the research on cognitive biases. You might know that a cognitive bias is a systematic tendency that leads our thinking away from a correct judgment. Psychology has found over 50 cognitive biases in the last 50 years. But there's one question that has not been answered yet. And this question was raised by one of my students when I taught psychology at university. She simply asked, how do I know that I experience such a bias in my daily life? And she was right. Researchers have found and analyzed these biases in a lab, under laboratory conditions, with no connection to reality. So I had a new challenge. How can I explain these cognitive biases without the academic background and select only those which are relevant to our daily life? Well, I thought a very long time on that. But finally, I found a fundamental underlying principle. I found out that there's a trap our mind falls into. I call this trap the mental harmony puzzle. It works like this. Number one, we start with some precious thought. And this thought is like a picture of a puzzle. Once we see the picture of a puzzle, it becomes a picture in our mind. Number two, when we're building the puzzle, this picture in our mind serves as a reference for us to build the puzzle. So any information that comes in, we check if it fits into the picture, then we put it into the puzzle. Any information that doesn't fit into the picture, we throw away. And as long as we follow this process, our mind feels in harmony, the mental harmony. Number three, we are building this puzzle not only with our consciousness, but also with our unconsciousness. And by definition, we are unaware of our unconscious processes. One of these unconscious processes is selective perception. Selective perception works like a filter. So it filters all information according to the picture in our mind, so that we can see and hear only that information that fits into the picture. So even if we started from a wrong picture, we would still see and hear that information that tells us, yeah, I was right. Yeah, exactly how I predicted. Yeah. So we wouldn't even realize that we end up in a wrong judgment. And that is a trap of the mental harmony puzzle. Now, to illustrate this, let me tell you the story of a friend named Sarah. I met her during my PhD studies, and she told me a lot about her dating life. And usually it started like this. Oh, Chan, I had a great date on the weekend. He was so intelligent and so handsome and so cool. Only positive aspects, not any negative ones. This is the so-called confirmation bias. It is a systematic tendency that we actively seek only information that confirms our beliefs, and we reject information that disconfirms our beliefs. So Sarah takes only those puzzle pieces of intelligence and attractiveness into her positive picture of her date, and she rejects information of negative ones, like he was not generous and didn't treat her during her dates. A couple of months later, I met Sarah again, and then she told me something different. Ah, he's so stubborn. You know, he never listens to me. And when I tell him he never listened to me, he tells me the same thing back. But objectively, I'm the much nicer person in this relationship. This is the so-called self-serving bias. It is a tendency that we focus our attention only to that information that enhances our self-esteem and protects us from any negative feedback. The underlying psychological mechanisms are similar to that of a confirmation bias. The difference is, in the confirmation bias, we are building a puzzle of a picture of just any kind of belief, like Sarah thinks her date is the best person. Whereas in the self-serving bias, we are building a puzzle of a picture of ourselves. So Sarah thinks she herself is the best person. A couple of months later, I met Sarah again. And then she told me, ah, he's so terrible. I had to end this relationship. Actually, you know, it was clear from the beginning. This relationship was not possible. I saw it all coming. Well, this is the so-called hindsight bias. is a tendency that we don't remember the past according to what we experienced, but to what happened later. So if we started to build a puzzle on a smiling face, and then reality turned bad, then we suddenly seem to remember it was a frowning face. Now, what can we learn from Sarah? The confirmation bias confirms our initial beliefs. The self-serving bias enhances our self-esteem. And the hindsight bias changes our memory of the past to reality. They have something in common. They are all based on one precious thought that our mind wants to preserve, so it can feel in mental harmony. But we have to fight this harmony because it triggers selective perception. And that makes our mind miss all the contradicting information. So if we started from a wrong picture, this contradicting information could turn a wrong into a right judgment. Now here's the good news. We can do something about that. We can actively reduce our biases by willpower. And here's how. Recommendation number one, fight the first impression. Studies have shown that you're forming your first impression of a person in the first 100 milliseconds. That is shorter than a glimpse of your eyes. So even before you have your first conscious thought about the person you're meeting, you're already holding a picture in your mind, and you're very reluctant to change this picture. So the takeaway message here is, constantly remind yourself that you're unaware of your first impression. If you do that, you're ready for recommendation number two. Jump to the other side. So once you know that you're already having a pre-built picture in your mind, you can explore the other side of the picture. There's one little trick. You have to find concrete evidence. So find out what you have seen or heard, like you've seen that this person helped an old woman over the street, or you've heard him respond in a friendly voice to an aggressive person. So the takeaway message here is, jump to the other side means find at least two concrete arguments of the opposite opinion. Now, you can also train your unconscious mind by recommendation number three. Define your inner focus. Once you become aware that you have a bias, for example, I don't like skinny persons, then you can reduce this bias by formulating an intention in the form, when I see a skinny person, I immediately remind myself of the great Gandhi. Now this works only if you do this repeatedly. So the takeaway message here is, repeatedly train your unconscious mind by an intention in the form, when I see a person of my bias, then I do this counteraction. Now all these takeaway messages are easy and simple to put into action. So why not start today and spread the word to others tomorrow? It will be hard work, but it's a little bit like climbing up a mountain. At first it's hard, then it becomes painful, but once you reach the top, you enjoy a great view. And the more often you do this, the easier it becomes. And if Sarah had done all that, I'm sure she would enjoy now a happy relationship with me.
Okay, so that was fun. So I'm going to go ahead and play the next video. That was Why We Are Wrong When We Think We Are Right by Chen So. C-H-A-E-H-A-N is his first name. Chen So. Last name So, S-O. Okay, so anyway, I'm going to play the next video.
So I'd like you to imagine for a moment that you're a soldier in the heat of battle. Maybe you're a Roman foot soldier, or a medieval archer, or maybe you're a Zulu warrior. regardless of your time and place, there are some things that are constant. Your adrenaline is elevated, and your actions are stemming from these deeply ingrained reflexes, reflexes rooted in a need to protect yourself and your side and to defeat the enemy. So now, I'd like you to imagine playing a very different role, that of the scout. So the scout's job is not to attack or defend. The scout's job is to understand. The scout is the one going out, mapping the terrain, identifying potential obstacles. And the scout may hope to learn that, say, there's a bridge in a convenient location across a river. But above all, the scout wants to know what's really there as accurately as possible. And in a real, actual army, both the soldier and the scout are essential. But you can also think of each of these roles as a mindset, a metaphor for how all of us process information and ideas in our daily lives. And what I'm going to argue today is that having good judgment, making accurate predictions, making good decisions, is mostly about which mindset you're in. So, to illustrate these mindsets in action, I'm going to take you back to 19th century France, where this innocuous-looking piece of paper launched one of the biggest political scandals in history. It was discovered in 1894 by officers in the French General Staff, and it was torn up in a waste paper basket, but when they pieced it back together, they discovered that someone in their ranks had been selling military secrets to Germany. So they launched a big investigation, and their suspicions quickly converged on this man, Albert Dreyfus. He had a sterling record, no past history of wrongdoing, no motive, as far as they could tell. But Dreyfus was the only Jewish officer at that rank in the army. And unfortunately, at this time, the French army was highly anti-Semitic. So they compared Dreyfus's handwriting to that on the memo and concluded that it was a match, even though outside professional handwriting experts were much less confident in the similarity. But never mind that. They went and searched Dreyfus's apartment, looking for any signs of espionage. They went through his files, and they didn't find anything. And this just convinced them more that Dreyfus was not only guilty, but sneaky as well, because clearly he had hidden all of the evidence before they had managed to get to it. Next, they went and looked through his personal history for any incriminating details. They talked to his teachers. They found that he had studied foreign languages in school, which clearly showed a desire to conspire with foreign governments later in life. His teachers also said that Dreyfus had a good memory, known for having a good memory, which was highly suspicious, right? You know, because a spy has to remember a lot of things. So the case went to trial, and Dreyfus was found guilty. And afterwards, they took him out into this public square and ritualistically tore his insignia from his uniform and broke his sword in two. This was called the degradation of Dreyfus. And they sentenced him to life imprisonment on the aptly named Devil's Island, which is this barren rock off the coast of South America. So there he went, and there he spent his days alone, writing letters and letters to the French government, begging them to reopen his case so they could discover his innocence. But for the most part, France considered the matter closed. So one thing that's really interesting to me about the Dreyfus affair is this question of why the officers were so convinced that Dreyfus was guilty. I mean, you might even assume that they were setting him up, that they were intentionally framing him, but historians don't think that's what happened. As far as we can tell, the officers genuinely believed that the case against Dreyfus was strong, which, you know, makes you wonder, what does it say about the human mind that we can find such paltry evidence to be compelling enough to convict a man? Well, this is a case of what scientists call motivated reasoning. It's this phenomenon in which our unconscious motivations, our desires and fears, shape the way we interpret information. So some information, some ideas feel like our allies, and we want them to win, we want to defend them. And other information or ideas are the enemy, and we want to shoot them down. So this is why I call motivated reasoning soldier mindset. And probably most of you have never persecuted a French Jewish officer for high treason, I assume. But maybe you've followed sports or politics. So you might have noticed that when the referee judges that your team committed a foul, for example, you're highly motivated to find reasons why he's wrong. But if he judges that the other team committed a foul, awesome. That's a good call. Let's not examine it too closely. Or maybe you've read an article or a study that examined some controversial policy, like capital punishment. And as researchers have demonstrated, if you support capital punishment and the study shows that it's not effective, then you're highly motivated to find all the reasons why the study was poorly designed. But if it shows that capital punishment works, awesome, it's a good study. And vice versa, if you don't support capital punishment, same thing. Our judgment is just strongly influenced, unconsciously, by which side we want to win. And this is ubiquitous. This shapes how we think about our health, our relationships, how we decide how to vote, what we consider fair or ethical. And what's most scary to me about motivated reasoning or soldier mindset is how unconscious it is. You know, we can think we're being objective and fair-minded and still wind up ruining the life of an innocent man. However, fortunately for Dreyfus, his story is not over. This is Colonel Picquart. He is another high-ranking officer in the French army. And like most people, he assumed Dreyfus was guilty. Also, like most people in the army, he was at least casually anti-Semitic. But at a certain point, Picquart began to suspect, what if we are all wrong about Dreyfus? And what happened was that he had discovered evidence that the spying for Germany had continued even after Dreyfus was in prison. And he had also discovered that another officer in the army had handwriting that perfectly matched the memo, much closer than Dreyfus's handwriting. So he brought these discoveries to his superiors, but to his dismay, they either didn't care or came up with elaborate rationalizations to explain his findings, like, all you've really shown, Picquart, is that there's another spy who learned how to mimic Dreyfus's handwriting, and he, you know, picked up the torch of spying after Dreyfus left. But Dreyfus is still guilty. Eventually, Picquart managed to get Dreyfus exonerated, but it took him 10 years, and for part of that time, he himself was in prison for the crime of disloyalty to the army. So, you know, a lot of people feel like Picquart can't really be the hero of this story because he was an anti-Semite, and that's bad, which I agree with. But personally, for me, the fact that Picquart was anti-Semitic actually makes his actions more admirable, because he had the same prejudices, the same reasons to be biased as his fellow officers, but his motivation to find the truth and uphold it just trumped all of that. So to me, Picquart is a poster child for what I call scout mindset. It's the drive not to make one idea win or another lose, but just to see what's really there as honestly and accurately as you can, even if it's not pretty or convenient or pleasant. And this mindset is what I'm personally passionate about, and what I've spent the last few years examining and trying to figure out what causes scout mindset. You know, why are some people, sometimes at least, able to cut through their own prejudices and biases and motivations and just try to see the facts and the evidence as objectively as they can? And the answer is emotional. So, just as soldier mindset is rooted in emotions like defensiveness or tribalism, scout mindset is too. It's just rooted in different emotions. So, for example, scouts are curious. They're more likely to say that they feel pleasure when they learn new information or an itch to solve a puzzle. They're more likely to feel intrigued when they encounter something that contradicts their expectations. Scouts also have different values. They're more likely to say that they think it's virtuous to test your own beliefs, and they're less likely to say that someone who changes his mind seems weak. And above all, scouts are grounded, which means that their self-worth as a person isn't tied to how right or wrong they are about any particular topic. So, you know, they can believe that capital punishment works, and if studies come out showing that it doesn't, they can say, looks like I might be wrong. Doesn't mean I'm bad or stupid, you know? So these traits, this cluster of traits, is what researchers have found, and I've also found anecdotally, predicts good judgment. And the key takeaway I want to leave you with about those traits is that they're primarily not about how smart you are or about how much you know. In fact, they don't correlate very much with IQ at all. They're about how you feel. So there's a quote that I keep coming back to by Saint-Exupéry. He's the author of The Little Prince. And he said, If you want to build a ship, don't drum up your men to collect wood and give orders and distribute the work. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. In other words, I claim, if we want to really improve our judgment as individuals and as societies, what we need most is not more instruction in logic or rhetoric or probability or economics, even though those things are quite valuable. But what we most need to use those principles well is scout mindset. We need to change the way we feel. We need to learn how to feel proud instead of ashamed when we notice we might have been wrong about something. We need to learn how to feel intrigued instead of defensive when we encounter some information that contradicts our beliefs. So the question I want to leave you with is, what do you most yearn for? Do you yearn to defend your own beliefs? Or do you yearn to see the world as clearly as you possibly can? Thank you.
Okay. I was trying to get that last quote down because it was a good one. What do you most yearn for? Do you yearn to defend your beliefs or to see the world as clearly as you possibly can? Something like that. So would anybody like to discuss their takeaways from the, oh, and I forgot to tell you the title of that one. You could see it was on the screen. Why You Think You're Right Even When You're Wrong, by Julie Galef, I think it was. I wrote it down, but I can't find it. So anyway, would anybody like to share their impressions? I am trying to get a full screen here. Is that George? Was that George in front of the Golden Gate Bridge? Hey, George. I can share a little bit if you all aren't ready to share, but it's cool either way. I thought they were, first of all, I thought they were both actually fun videos, even though there was tons of information in them. Maybe it was a little ambitious to try and do a doubleheader, given that there was so much information. I really liked the takeaways from Chin So's talk. The three recommendations he had for this confirmation bias that he talked about were fight the first impression. And really, in fighting the first impression, it's the same thing that we always teach here. You can't fight it if you don't know you have it, right? You have to bring it up into your awareness. So become aware that, and that's really what he's saying when he says fight your first impression, become aware that you have formed an impression about this person before you ever have a conscious thought about them, this person, this event, this anything, right? You have, so realize, you know, it's like, it's amazing that any of us can ever do any purification whatsoever when we have all these built-in human tendencies, right? But so realize, you have, your brain works on a confirmation bias basis. So realize that going in, so that if somebody says something, somebody you just met says something, and you go, realize that's probably based on some a puzzle picture that you put in your brain before you ever had a conscious thought about that person, right? So that's the first thing. Realize that you have this tendency and that you probably already have formed an idea about what this person, situation, anything else represents. The second thing he said was jump to the other side. And, you know, this is reminded me, of course, of Byron Katie's turnaround. I figured it would you too, Don. Yeah, since you do so much work with Byron Katie. In fact, he even says find at least two concrete arguments for the opposing opinion. I mean, isn't that great? It's like, this is how you fight against this confirmation bias that you're going to have going into any situation. You're going to have it. And then third, and I just loved it. Define your inner focus. Formulate an intention. I mean, isn't that beautiful? He's not saying, you know, Holy Spirit told me to tell you to form. No, he's not. He's like, this is how you fight this scientifically defined confirmation bias. Formulate an intention and do this repeatedly. Reprogram your brain, in other words, right? To have an opposite view, a counter view. And often in Awakening Together, we talk about focus instead of that negative thought, focus on the thought of the day. Focus on your workbook lesson, right? Do something other than just go, oh, yeah, I believe that thought. So it's just really cool to see this guy use these scientific principles to teach exactly what we learn in Awakening Together, what Byron Katie's teaching. I just thought that was really, really cool. So, okay. So I've shared a little bit. Anybody else want to share a little bit? Dawn.
Well, I second what you said about the Byron Katie. That is one of the things I was going to mention. I just love it was so cute that at the end of the Chin So, he was like, Sarah might have stayed with him. He was the one he was talking about the whole time. So I thought that was interesting. One thing that I was thinking could be a helpful exercise to open the mind to, because he was talking about how we want that mental harmony. What was he called? Harmony puzzle. The mental harmony puzzle. So I thought of in my mind's eye, like this is actually probably have happened to most people at least once, if you're ever into puzzles, and somehow over the course of time, you know, maybe one or two pieces goes missing, is lost. You've spent all that time on those 500,000 piece puzzles, come to the very end, and there's that one piece missing. And there's a felt sensation. You could just think of it right now, that piece is missing, and there's an energetic sensation of like, oh, I want that piece to complete. There's a feeling of completion that we want. And so I was like, I wonder if that would be a helpful meditation to embrace the uncomfortableness of like accepting the imperfect as it is, and being open, like, because both of them talked. See, Chin Sho was showing us exactly how to embrace the open mind. And then the next lady was talking about how having an open mind would help us. So that's what we're learning here. And then, but I wonder if we're doing that selective reasoning now, because, like, I notice, like, I want to filter out the negative. I want to focus in on anything over relating to awakening and how that applies to my healing. So that is selective. I am being selective now, but I'm trying to be selective in a way that is going to cause me to awaken, which I guess you could call it harmony. You could call it a harmony, but I'm seeing that in the way the mind wants harmony, it's not going to happen. Because it seems to me, even if when you awaken, I mean, just look at these gurus. I've seen it time and time again. It's like even Muji, there's stuff out very negative about him. You know, some people have wrote in and made videos, and, you know, I'm sure, you know, even just having the people come to him constantly at these satsangs who are so entrenched in their suffering, and they believe it 100%. Well, his apparent reality is showing suffering because these people are showing up. So even when you become enlightened, it's still going to be there. Maybe it doesn't trigger you anymore. Like, obviously it doesn't trigger Muji to pop out of his joy, bliss, or whatever he's feeling. Because you can still hear the clarity coming through. And so my thing is like the analogy of the missing puzzle piece. Well, maybe that's okay. That's the openness. Because like I've heard before, like it's your broken, those holes in the tapestry Like your life is, the metaphor is your tapestry. And say, for instance, when you lose someone or something that was very important to you, now it's like there's this hole in the tapestry, but that's where the light shines in. You know, the awareness, the spirit, the love, the joy, however you want to label the divine, that hole is where the divine gets in. So what if all these, like the missing puzzle piece was like that, where that's where the light is shining through? And then just to be open to that, to be open to these parts that they seem not so pretty or not so harmonious, but yet to be with them in such a way like Chin Sho was sharing. So Chin Sho. Okay, I'm going to let go.
Thank you, Dawn, for sharing. Yeah, that was really interesting. You know, you talk about these people who are suffering, who seem to be suffering, come into Muji. And when you were talking about that, I was thinking about that old joke where, you know, the guy goes, "Doctor, doctor, it hurts when I go like this." And the doctor goes, "Well, quick one like that," which is Muji's job, right? Muji, Muji, it hurts when I think like this. Well, quit thinking like that, you know? So anyway, that's what ran through my mind. Thank you for your sharing. Who else would like to share? Connie.
Yeah, I want to say it occurred to me that the takeaway message of the first guy, the takeaway message number two, jump to the other side, kind of reminded me of A Course in Miracles, that whole initial idea that got the course started, and that was their willingness and wanting to see things from in a different way.
Yeah, there's got to be a better way. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Good insight. Thank you for sharing. Who else would like to share? Donna.
I can get it unmuted. Sometimes this thing just doesn't want to unmute. But I didn't fight it. And I also liked that second part of Chin's takeaways, the jump to the other side. I just thought it takes courage. It takes consciousness. It takes awareness to be able to do that, to be entrenched in an idea and think, this doesn't feel right, you know, feeling the contraction of that judgment, and then there must be another way, and then jumping to the other side, which is so cool to dig a new pathway in your brain by thinking completely outside the box, because a completely different way of looking at things. And that's what really struck me also. And I also did think of Byron Katie's turnaround too, which is the perfect. She asked us to give three examples of the opposite point of view. And then the other lady I really liked also was actually she echoed your talk this morning about defensiveness, because let's see, the warrior drive was to defend ideas, all ideas, even if you might be wrong, even if you know you're wrong. People defend their ideas, especially if they start getting into lies or the story gets thicker and thicker and they can't remember what lie they told. And at that point, they don't even want to think that, oh, I could be wrong. Whereas the scout mentality, there's a deep curiosity to know what's really going on. And you talked about that. Didn't you talk about that this morning?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, maybe. But I thought that talk went along with what I talked about this morning.
Yeah, that deep curiosity to just drop the fact that you might be wrong for the love of truth.
Yeah.
Drop that defending the self, you know, the little self that's not even real, and just be open and curious and embrace truth. I just loved her message about that. So that's my sharing.
Thank you for sharing, Shauna. Thank you. When you were speaking about Byron Katie, I was reminded, I listened in preparing for this morning's homily, I listened to Byron Katie talking to somebody about defense and all that. But one of the things she said that seemed really helpful for me was, she was leading somebody through the turnarounds, and she's like, this whole turnaround process is not intended to be a quick fix thing. It's for you to really look at the other possibilities that exist, to really contemplate other things that are equally true or more true as the thing that you're believing. It's an invitation for, she didn't say magic, but magic is the word that's coming to mind, for the magic of the universe to inform you of what's really going on. You know, it's not just a rote thing where you're going to get your problems fixed, you know, where you didn't have money to pay the rent and now you do, right? Or you're upset because you didn't have the money to pay the rent and now you're not upset. It's really an invitation to contemplate what's truly going on. And so it makes it a very, very deep process. And some of the turnarounds may make sense or not, but it's an exploration of what's equally true or more true. So, yeah, so from that perspective, I think it's just really beautiful. I loved that second talk. She's talking about the scout mentality, you know, about it all being a mentality, this cognitive bias and how you greet the world, right? Either with the soldier mentality, where I'm going to defend myself and my beliefs, or, oh, gosh, how interesting, I was wrong, and being intrigued and being curious about that. And it reminded me of, you know, what the Course talks about with the happy learner. That's what the whole happy learner thing's about. Oh my gosh, look what I was believing. Right? And just wanting to see where I have been misperceiving. It's just a flip of that coin. It's a willingness to see where you're wrong. And that was so cool. That was one of the things that was so cool about what she said. And so she said, well, what are the traits of the scout mentality as opposed to the soldier mentality? The traits were being curious, being open, and being grounded. And I really liked the being grounded thing, because she was talking about a fundamental sense of self-worth. Your self-worth is not based on on the validity of your ideas, on whether or not you're right. And that is the difference between the scout and the soldier mentality. You know, my self-worth depends on me being right for the soldier, right? And the scout's more, again, wants to know, no, what really is going on? What really is the truth? What is it that I have been missing for all these years, or for the last 10 minutes, or in this conversation? And it was just really cool for her to point it out in the way that she did. I also liked the fact that, you know, it's history, so I can like it or not like it, but I also like the fact that the guy that was mistakenly imprisoned was named Dreyfus. I hadn't heard of Dreyfus before Richard Dreyfus, right? And I liked the fact that the other guy's name, the guy that helped him become exonerated, was Picard. Picard. I thought, I wonder if that's where they got Captain Picard in. I know the spelling's different, but that's sure what I thought of when I heard of Picard. And, you know, why not? Altruistic and all those, because that's the character that they were making, right? Somebody who was open-minded, somebody who was curious. This whole scout mindset is, you know, the personification is personified by Picard in the Star Trek series. Yeah. So, Shauna, you're unmuted. Did you want to share something? You're good. Oh, muted, unmuted.
This darn I don't know what it does. But I did actually, because I remembered from your homily this morning, it was Byron Katie that said somebody told her, you're being unkind. And she said, tell me more. That was like, yeah, if somebody tells me, you know, Shauna, you're stupid. If I just go tell me more, that takes care of the whole defense thing. That takes care of me thinking. That just goes right into curiosity and openness.
Isn't it fascinating? Then there's nothing to defend. There's nothing to defend. And it's, and again, from the message this morning, it's just, it struck me when I came up with that title, or maybe that's why I came up with the title or whatever, but it struck me. It's so funny. Anytime I'm defending, what am I defending? Oh, ego. Oh, this image of myself that I like, you know, I'm meditating all day and I'm doing all these practices to get rid of, but no one will tell me I'm, you know, it's just really funny. Wait, what am I defending? Yeah. Who else would like to share? We have a few minutes left. Let me see. Was there anything else I took? I'm happy to hear from anybody else. I'm just looking at my notes. Yeah, and Dawn, a while ago, you were talking about selective perception. And again, I think it's just the way we're built as humans. We're operating under that cognitive bias or that selective perception all the time. I loved when he pulled out the filters and he put the filters up to his eyes and then he put the filters up to his ears. I thought that was just such a lovely illustration of the way we go through life. And he says, and all of these biases, oh gosh, and they were great too. He's the self-serving bias. We focus on enhancing our self-esteem and reject any negative feedback. I mean, we do this subconsciously, right? So anything that says, yeah, you're great, you're like, yeah, you're ready to accept it. Anything that says, well, maybe not, you're like, no, they can't be talking about me. And that's a built-in bias, the self-serving bias. He talked about the hindsight bias, that when we look back on the past, we don't look back and see it as it actually was. We see it according to, we don't see it according to our actual, the actual experience, but we see it according to what happened later. What happened later is the filter that we see the past through. And, you know, we'll swear up and down that's exactly what happened, because we're wearing the filters of what has happened since then, right? It colors the way we see the past. Dawn.
I think that's a huge, important point you're bringing up. And the reason I say that is because I believe that what I had been doing to myself, and I still have to catch myself doing it, is the ego preservation strategy of wanting to, let's just use it as it is, beat myself up because, well, what if I would have done this differently or this differently? Well, what I have to remember, and even Byron Katie says it, but I have to keep reminding myself that I had those particular beliefs in my mind at that time when I was raising Alex. So, of course, that belief that I wasn't good enough or that he didn't love me or that I was mean or that I was hurting him, all these beliefs, this whole web of lies, web of beliefs, because I've actually challenged a lot of the beliefs, and when I get to the other side, I can see that they're not true, or at least not all the way absolutely, you know, they're not absolutely true. So what ends up happening is now I think to myself that whole thing will, now I know better. But then, you know what I'm saying? So then you bring in a very important point home. This hindsight bias can actually be an ego preservation strategy where I'm actually hurting myself with actually the knowledge that I've gained. Could have done better. No, I couldn't. I could not have done better because I had all those beliefs in there that I was.
That those choices weren't available to you.
I didn't even know it.
Yeah.
I didn't even know it.
Yeah.
So I think the amazing thing is when you're brave at anyone, everyone, when you pop through a belief and you see the damage that it causes by believing that, and you've let go of that, that gives you the impetus, the courage to do it again, and to where it, like, it's starting to unravel.
Yeah.
It's unraveling. So yeah. Okay. Letting go.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. I talked over you a moment ago, and I apologize for that. But I heard in what you said, what I've heard Regina say, specifically when she was teaching the code, you know, no, I couldn't have made a different choice in the past. That choice wasn't even available. It wasn't even within the spectrum of choices that were available to me at that time. I could not have made a different choice. So yeah, so I really appreciate what you said. Let me bring up. Let's see. He said he had. He had the self-serving bias and the hindsight bias, and they're all based on this confirmation bias. They're all based on us wanting to maintain mental harmony. He called it. You know, and we might call it an ego image of ourselves. You know, we just want everything to be just so, right? We don't want to upset our relationship to the world. So we want it all to look just like this. And that causes us to subconsciously engage in these biases that are actually filters on the truth of what's happening in any given moment. I know we are about out of time. Seemed like there's one more thing I had. Maybe not. Maybe not. Oh, and gosh, I love that quote, and I got it in paraphrase from the person who wrote The Little Prince. If you want to build a ship, you don't gather a bunch of men and tell them how to put the wood together and how to do this and how to build a ship, right? He says, you teach men to yearn for the vast and endless sea. And that's how you get men to build a ship. And it's the same, again, it's the same thing that we look at here in Awakening Together. We hold our true desire as a beacon, you know? It's not, you know, I'm not going to whip you into shape by going, there you are judging again. I'm going to whip you into shape by having you focus on your spiritual aspiration, on your true desire, on your yearning for the vast and endless sea. So, yeah, so I just thought that was really, really cool. That she brought that quote in at the last. So, as always, it's fun, fun, fun. I love being here with you guys. I'm really enjoying doing this program with you guys. I appreciate your insights, and I'll see you girls, and I'll see you next time. Bye.